very much.
And speaking about kashrus, we should start from the basics. The Torah tells us that we're not permitted to eat any and every animal. As far as behema or chaya, as far as animals are concerned, it has to be an animal that's kosher, namely that it has split hoofs, and it has malagera, that it chews its cud. The Chochma Sodom, who was a dayan in Vilna, a little after the Vilna Goyen, he was a mechutna of the Vilna Goyen's son. Chochma Sodom claims that the minig is that we don't eat any animal unless we have even if we can identify that it has split hoofs and it chews its cud. We only eat animals that we have a tradition on that they're kosher, because sometimes we can make a mistake and think that it's mala gera, and it really isn't. Mafis Par said there's nothing to make a mistake about. But mala gera, sometimes experts have made mistakes. So that's why in Eretz Yisrael years ago, and just about 5 years ago, over 50 years ago, there was a tumul, and about 5 years ago, there was a tumul about the zebu. It's an animal that's very common in Argentina, where they do a lot of shechita, that the meat is sent to Eretz Yisrael. So every so often they'll shecht a zebu. A zebu has split hoofs, and it chews its cud. But it doesn't look like a cow. It's a little different from a cow. So the Chazon Ish made a whole tumult about this over 50 years ago, at the time that Rabbi Herzog was the chief rabbi, and the dairy industry was interested in bringing in the zebu to Eretz Yisrael, because the milk of the zebu is almost as good as cow's milk, and it doesn't have to drink as much. And in Eretz Yisrael, it's a very hot climate, so the animals have to drink a lot. So the zebu has a milo that is like a camel, that it can drink water, and it doesn't have to drink water every day. Every 3 days is enough. So at that time, the Chazon Ish made a whole tumult, that even though the zebu is a kosher animal, the litvakis follow all the minhagim that appear in the Chochma Sodom, so the litvakis won't be able to eat. It'll cause a big problem. All the milk and all the cheese, all the milchiks that'll come from this zebu will be treif, because the litvakis have this minig that they only eat animals they have a masor on. So at that time, Rabbi Herzog gave in to the Chazon Ish, and they didn't introduce it. But since then, the non-Jews have succeeded in breeding the zebu with the cow until they came to the realization that if you have, I forgot exactly what the proportions are, 5/8 one and 3/8 the other one, either 5/8 cow or 5/8 zebu and the other one, then you have the best of both worlds. And the milk tastes like regular cow's milk, and the animal is like a camel, that it doesn't have to drink so much water. There's a prohibition. It's a pasuk in the Chumash. You're not allowed to hybrid different animals. So this was done by non-Jews. But once you can succeed in breeding the two animals, and then the fact that we have a tradition that we have a tradition that it's kosher, and the Gemara tells us, and it's a fact of biology, that a kosher and a non-kosher animal cannot breed together and have vlodis. So from the fact that they did breed them together, the Goyim breeded them, and they have a lot of this, and they figured out that if it's 5/8 this and 3/8 that, it has the best of both worlds. So the tradition that we have that the cow is kosher carries over to the zebu also. So 5 years ago, they started the tumult all over again, that in Bnei Brak, they announced, I remember it was on Shabbos, Parsha Zohar, because we had some Israeli guests eating by us on Shabbos, so they heard the whole tumult, that they announced that no one should eat their cholent until Shabbos, because all the flesh is treif, because they came to the realization that some of the butcher shops in Bnei Brak were selling zebu meat that was geschachten properly, but it wasn't cow's meat, it was zebu meat. So the tumult only lasted about 2 weeks, because then they realized that they hybrid these with cows and they have lotus, so obviously the thing is kosher. So step number one, you have to make sure that you're eating a behemah that's a min tohar. It has to be a kosher animal. The question is about buffalo. In Shulchan Aruch, they talk about buffalo, so you see that clearly they're eating buffalo. They just have a suffix whether buffalo is a behema or a chaya, whether you need kisei adam or you don't need kisei adam, whether the chelev is muta, the chelev is aser, but it's clear that the buffalo is kosher. But what they call buffalo in the days of the Rishonim is not the same as what we call buffalo today. It's a totally different animal. So that's why there was a bit of a tumult regarding the American buffalo. The Hasidim would prefer to eat buffalo because it's always glatt kosher. We'll have to explain what that means a little later. It rarely, rarely has any sirchas on the lungs. So the question was, but there's no tradition on buffalo. So they came to the realization that the buffalo There is a tradition on the buffalo. The buffalo is kosher. So they're not, most are not worried about that. As far as birds are concerned, next week is Thanksgiving. Many people eat turkey on Thanksgiving. So the Gemara in Chulin gives you a big discussion. How do you identify whether any given bird is kosher or non-kosher? The Chumash does not give simanim. The Chumash just gives you a list of non-kosher birds. And anything that's not on the list is automatically kosher. The overwhelming majority of all the birds in the world are kosher, unless you know what's on the list. Now, we don't know exactly what these birds correspond to. So it's not going to help if we're going to read the Chumash if we don't know which are the non-kosher birds. So the Gemara has it, the Mishnah has it, and the Gemara has a whole discussion. There are four simonim. There are different opinions. And the Shulchan Aruch has adopted the most stringent opinion, that if you have four simonim to identify, there are four biological aspects that a bird has to have in order to determine that it's a kosher bird. So all the birds that we eat are kosher, of course. The turkey has all the four simonim. So by means of identification, the turkey should be kosher. However, the Gemara tells a story that the Amoraim, the Tzadikim in the days of the Talmud, the Amoraim found a bird that they never saw before, and they determined that it's a kosher bird because it had all the four simonim, and they were all eating it, and then they realized years later that they made a mistake. They made a mistake in determining that it was kosher. One of the simonim was not Dois Gehalten. So they realized that they were eating a non-kosher bird. So Rashi comments on that Gemara, if the holy Amoraim made a mistake, so we can certainly make a mistake, so we should only eat birds that we have a tradition on. So Rashi is recommending this, and this is the tradition of the Ashkenazim. The Sfardim never had such a practice, but the Ashkenazim have this. After the days of Rashi, we have this, the Sefer Issa V'Heter, that's quoted on every page in Yerideya. Issa V'Heter is written by the Rabbeinu Yoina. There are two Rabbeinu. There's a famous Rabbeinu Yoina from Spain, and then Rabbeinu Yoina Gerondi, and then the Rabbeinu Yoina Ashkenazi. So the Issa V'Heter is written by the different Rabbeinu Yoina, but it's always quoted in Shulchan Aruch. So the Issa V'Heter quotes this minhag from the days of Rashi. You should only eat a bird that you have a tradition on. Even if you identify that it has all the four simonim of kashrus, you shouldn't eat the bird. So what happened was, some professor in Eretz Yisrael put out a whole book on the issue of birds. So he has a whole chapter about turkey. So he writes the Hishtal Shalos Hadvarim, the whole history was that when Columbus came back to Europe and he brought with him turkeys, so the Svardim took the turkey and they checked it and they saw that it has all the four simonim. So they're reading the turkey because the Svardim never had such a meaning, not to eat a bird unless you have a masorah. The Svardim follow what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yosef Kara writes, any bird that has the four simonim, it's kosher, so you just shecht and you eat it. Then after 50 years or so of the Svardim eating these birds, so the Ashkenazim looked and they said, look, they must have a tradition that it's kosher. Religious people, they're eating the bird. So then the Ashkenazim started to eat it. And then 50 years later, the Rabbanim woke up and they said, what's going on here? There never was a tradition on the turkey. The Jews never lived in America. Some of the Rabbanim wrote, well, the lost ten tribes are the Indians in America, and they used to eat it, so the Indians ate non-kosher things also. What do you mean? There was a masorah that the turkey was kosher. It never was such a masorah. So there were Rabbanim who were tumbling that you're not allowed to eat turkey because it's a non-kosher bird. The Shalos family is known. Shalos family, his name is Horowitz. So the Shalos family doesn't eat turkey. He was opposed to eating turkey. There's a Rebbe Nishiva, Rabbi David Horowitz, who's a descendant from the Shalos. So he says there are members of his family who eat chazer. They don't keep Shabbos and kashrus and anything, but turkey? Absolutely not. That's out of the question. I never eat turkey. They don't realize what's the issue. Turkey means it's a shayla. Maybe it's a non-kosher. But the one who did away with the whole machlekes, they quote, historically, was the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov didn't like it that Rabbonim were mekatreg on Klal Yisrael, that they tumult, that were in violation of the minhag. So the Baal Shem Tov said, the turkey is kosher, let's stop draying a cup. So from that time on, it was generally accepted that we don't tumult about the turkey, even though really, this professor writes in the book that if the issue of the turkey would have come out up in our generation, would have never gotten to first base. The Rabbanim would have made a tumult. The Rabbanim are much more alert today than they were in the 1500s, and the Ashkenazim would never have accepted it. Okay, so usually we're careful about the birds. As far as fish are concerned, so the Torah does give simonim. The Torah says if you have a fish that has fins and scales, so then you know that it's kosher. Swordfish was an issue. Well, going back a little earlier, sturgeon. The sturgeon has fins and scales. The only thing is that the scales on the sturgeon are not regular. They're attached on both sides. Normally, when you have scales on a fish, so you take a knife and you scrape off all the scales by scraping in one direction. The scales on the swordfish, you cannot scrape in one direction. It's attached on both ends. So you have to put, if you want to remove them, you have to put the knife under the scale and yank it out. You have to pull it out. So the Ramban in his commentary on Chumash writes, he doesn't think that that's acceptable. He doesn't talk about a sturgeon. He just writes an abstract about a scale. A scale is only a simon for tahara, for the kashrus of the fish, if it's only attached on one side. So the later poskim are not so convinced that we have to follow this Ramban. It's an original chiddush, and it doesn't have any support in the Talmud. So there was a machlokes about this. In the beginning of the Reform movement, in the days of the Chasam Sofer, there was an Orthodox rabbi who later became a Reform rabbi. He was one of the leaders of the Reform movement. He was known, they referred to him with the derogatory term of Acher. Acher was a Tana who became an Apikoros, who gave up the whole Jewish religion. Elisha ben Avui was known as Acher. So this Orthodox rabbi who turned into a Reform rabbi was known as Acher because that was the Rosh Yeshivas of his name, Aharon Chariner Rabiner. So the Chasam Sofer always talks about Acher, the Rosh Yeshivas. So this Acher, when he was still an Orthodox rabbi, he had the crusade, he had the campaign that everybody should realize that sturgeon is kosher. There's nothing wrong, that we don't pass like this Ramban. And others were arguing, it's a debate whether you have to be concerned about the Ramban. Then when he became a Reform rabbi, so they all said, you see, we knew all along he was no good, he was not Orthodox, he was Reformed from the beginning and not let eat. So that's the issue with sturgeon. It's generally assumed that Orthodox people don't eat sturgeon. We are concerned about the Ramban. The swordfish has regular scales on it. They're not the same shape as the scales that you have on other fish, but the Shulchan Aruch says it doesn't make a difference what the shape is, and what the consistency is. In South Africa, they have a fish that's called the kingklip fish. So the so many years ago, I guess 80 years ago, there was a Rabbi Kosofsky who was a rabbi there, a dayan in South Africa. He was the brother-in-law of Rabbi Chaim Oizer. He used to consult a lot with Rabbi Chaim Oizer on all religious issues. So Rabbi Kosofsky paskin that this kingklip is a kosher fish, that it has fins and scales. And ever since, every 20 years, there's somebody who makes a whole tumult about the kingklip. The issue, the main issue being that that the scales that it has are very, very soft. It's just like another layer of skin. So if you have a fish that has two layers of skin, that doesn't count as scales. You have to have scales. Something should be like a plastic, a consistency of a plastic. So it doesn't really have it. So that's a debate. That's a debate now. The Rabbonim, the Beis Din in South Africa, has this tradition from the days of Rabbi Kosofsky that there's nothing wrong with the kingklip. And there are those who debate it. In the days of the Rishonim, there was a big dispute about Barbuta. Barbuta is some kind of a fish, and they don't tell you what the fish is. They just identify it by the name. And one of the Rabbonim paskin that it's kosher, and then he had a dream at night that they were complaining to him from heaven. He's doing such a terrible aver as if he's feeding all the people chaza, because he paskin that the Barbuta fish was kosher. So the next day he woke up and he realized he has to reverse his psak. He told everybody you shouldn't eat Barbuta. What's the whole issue of Barbuta? So the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Kara in Yoredeya, quotes from the Hagos Rabbeinu Peretz on the Smach. The Barbuta fish is the following. It has fins and scales. But some Rishonim felt that fins and scales is only a simen tahara on a fish if it looks like a fish. And the Barbuta doesn't look like a fish. Why doesn't it look like a fish? A fish, in order to have the correct shape of a fish, has to have a tail that's indented. You have the head, the nose, whatever, and the big belly, the whole body. Then you have the tail should be indented. And the Barbuta fish is straight at the end. So this was the big debate. Does that have the tzura of a fish? The accepted opinion is yes, we eat sole. Sole fish has fins and scales, and it does not have an indented tail. It's just a straight tail. So this whole hullabaloo that they had in the days of the Bavli HaTosfos about the Barbuta, today it's accepted. Whatever the Barbuta was, today it's accepted that such a fish would not pose a problem. The only thing that might be a question is, what if you have a marine animal that has fins and scales and has legs and arms and it has eyes and it walks around? It doesn't. Let's say you have a frog that has fins and scales. You say fins and scales are only a simon of kashrus if the thing is really a fish, or any sea animal would be kosher if it has fins and scales. So this is a debate in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. The Pri Chodesh thinks that any marine animal that has fins and scales is kosher, even if it doesn't look at all like a fish. And the Aruch HaShulchan thinks, Neitzel, this is a shayla. This is a king clip in South Africa. It doesn't exactly look like a fish. It really looks like an eel to me. The little that I saw, they showed me a video of it. Looks to me like an eel.
So back to swordfish. So is swordfish kosher?
Swordfish, strictly speaking, is really kosher. Yeah, swordfish is really kosher. There's a professor, Sternberg. He's a big genius in mathematics. I think he's at Harvard. So he publishes from time to time, he publishes an essay in the Bar Ilan journal that's called BDD, B'chol D'Rachecha D'Ehu. So they have a journal that has one end is in English, one end is in Hebrew. They have essays usually on Torah and science, or Torah and economics, you know, Torah Mada essays. So he's a big super genius in many areas in addition to his main expertise in mathematics. He's a big mathematician. So he published an essay several years ago where he writes that Rabbi Soloveitchik, he lives in the Boston area, he writes that Rabbi Soloveitchik asked him to check into the story with the swordfish, and he scraped off the scales and he showed it to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he said that these are perfectly normal scales. So he writes in his essay that whoever is interested, I have the envelope with the scales on my Gemara Avodah Zarah, so whoever wants, I'll show you the scales. I remember they showed me a swordfish. It looked like regular scales to me. It's not the same shape as scales from other fish, but the Shulchan Aruch says it doesn't matter what the shape is. In America, what happened was that years ago, Rabbi Tendler was the only one who knew anything about science and Torah. So he was the one who made the list of the kosher and the non-kosher fish. So he put swordfish under the list of the non-kosher fish. But in Eretz Yisrael, in many restaurants, they will serve you a swordfish on the hashgacha. There's really, strictly speaking, there's nothing wrong with swordfish. It really is kosher. But then I had other reasons why he wanted to ask the swordfish. Because at that time, the conservative rabbinate was interested in getting involved in kashrus, so he wanted to knock them out, which at that time he succeeded because of his whole tumult about the swordfish. But strictly speaking, really has regular scales, and it's really a kosher fish.
There's a sailfish that they say has real scales, like it's similar to a swordfish. It's called a sailfish.
There are many, many fish. The Rishonim say it's impossible to insist that you should only eat fish if you have a masora, like we say by birds, and the Chacham Sodom says by behemoths. It's impossible because there are tens of thousands of different kinds of fish. It's not shy if you should require a masora on fish. You say, fair, you don't need a masora on fish, you just have to determine whether it has fins and scales. And any fish that has scales, we assume automatically has fins. So you only have to look for scales. And the scales, the only thing says doesn't matter what shape, doesn't matter which part of the body it's on, and it's enough to be a scimitar. Then once you have a kosher animal, so then the din requires you have a kosher behemoth, you have a kosher bird, so the din requires you have to shecht it. If you go to the A&P and you buy meat from a kosher animal that didn't have a proper shechita, so that's a nisa nevela. Any animal that didn't have a proper shechita is also because of nevela. If it had a shechita, but it was a diseased animal, so then we have a long list in Shulchan Aruch of the 70 different trefas, the ayin trefas. So if the animal was a diseased animal, so the shechita, which was a proper shechita, removes the tumor. If you pick up, let's say, someone picks up a package of non-kosher meat in the A&P, so it makes it tummy. Because nevela is matame b'maga b'masa. Maga would be if I touch it with my bare hands. It's all wrapped up, so you can't touch it with your bare hands. So if you pick up the package, that's called tumas masa. Nothing wrong. Whoever attended a funeral is already Tumas Mace anyway. And even a Kohen is not permitted to come in contact with a dead body. It means a dead body of a human being, a dead body of a behemoth. He's permitted to be metamic to that. So if you pick up a package of Nevela meat in the A&P, even though it's wrapped and there's no Tumas Magal, there's going to be Tumas Masa. But if you have an animal that was geshochten properly by a Jewish Shechet, if a non-Jew shechts it, it's not considered a shechita. But if a Jew shechts a kosher animal, if a Jew shechts an elephant, that's going to be an nevela. Or if a non-Jew shechts a cow, that's going to be an nevela. But if a Jew shechts a cow and happens that it's a diseased animal, we're not allowed to eat it because it has one of it has a broken leg, it has a hole in the lungs, it has a water in the brain, whatever. It has any one of the 70 trefas, so then you're not allowed to eat it. That's called a trefa, that's not called an nevela. So that's not metame if you pick it up. That's the whole story of glatt kosher, there are 70 different treifas, and the Ramban writes in his commentary in the beginning of on the Gemara Chulin, in the beginning of Maseches Chulin, that we don't after we shecht an animal, we don't check to ascertain that it doesn't have any of the 70 kinds of treifas. We only check for one type of treifas, namely the sirchas on the lungs, the adhesions on the lungs. Why is that so? So the Ramban explains, because the possibility of an animal having a sircha on the lung is what we would call a miut hamotzui. That's the expression that he coined that term. That's a common occurrence. It's way less than 50%. It's not a real suffix, but since it's a miut hamotzui, it's a midirabanon, one is required to check the animal, to check the lungs, to make sure that it doesn't have any sirchas. As far as all the other possibilities of treifas, you're not mechuyev to go check, because it's a miut shein hamotzui. It's highly unlikely that the animal is going to have a problem. Unless an animal fell down a flight of stairs, and then being involved in this accident, maybe some of the ribs got broken, and maybe the broken rib punctured a lung, so then you have to check to see that by falling down the flight of stairs, it didn't become a treifa. But if you have a normal animal, you don't see anything wrong with it, the only thing you have to check for is the lungs. And then when you check for the sirchas on the lungs, so in the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes, and the Sfardim follow the Psalm of Rabbi Yosef Karo, that if the Shechet finds there is an adhesion on the lung that goes from one lobe to the other, so if it can be removed very easily, if you can peel it off very easily, so that's not called the Sircha, so that doesn't make a Trefa. But what happens if you have a real Sircha that's really stuck, and you have to rub and rub and rub and rub till you remove it, and after you remove it, you see that there is no hole on that lobe of the lung, so then Rabbi Yosef Karo says that's if it's not easily removable, so then it's a simon that this behema was a trefa. And the Ramo was Mekel, and the Ashkenazim followed this kula of the Ramo. Usually when you learn Hilchas Trefas, usually Rabbi Yosef Karo is always Mekel on things, and the Ramo is always Machmer on things. And now here the Ramo is Mekel against Rabbi Yosef Karo. And the history books, they write that this one kula of the Ramo outweighs all the Chumras that he wrote in Hilchas Trefas. So the Ashkenazim are mekal on that even if the sircha is not easily removable, you have to rub and rub and rub. In Europe, it was a big hepsid moment. If the butcher bought a behemoth, it turns out that it's a treifa. What's he going to do with it? So he has to sell it to the non-Jews, and he's going to lose a lot of money because he paid so much money for the shechet to shecht it. Now in America, it's not such a problem because they shecht, they have a slaughterhouse, and whatever they make, an avail or a trefa, so they sell it as unkosher. So they don't waste any time. They don't have to waste any time checking to make sure that anything that has a slight shayla on it, they're not going to waste time to try to rub and rub and rub and remove the sircha. So strictly speaking, this is the difference in kashrus and behemoths between Ashkenazim and Sfardim. That Sfardim are insistent that it has to be glat kosher. Glat means smooth. The lung has to be smooth. And if it has a sircha, if it has an adhesion, and you had to work hard to remove it, so the Sfardim would not permit that, they would consider that a treifa. And the Ashkenazim would be mekel on that. That's why in Eretz Yisrael, traditionally, before Hakamas HaMedina, before 1948, there was a Sephardic chief rabbi, and then they had Ashkenazim, had their own system, because they used to give Kabbalah to the Shochtim, they used to give Hashkochas on the flesh. So the Sfardim have different standards for the Ashkenazim. The Sephardic standards, as far as treifas is concerned, were more strict than the Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim allowed the removal of the sirchas by rubbing hard. So that's what's officially that's called glat kosher. Glat means that it's smooth, that they didn't have to work hard to remove all of the sirchas.
Should it been glat in Beis Yosef glat?
That means Beis Yosef glat. Beis Yosef glat means that it's smooth. Glat in America means a different thing. When there was a Shochtim's union. Everything in America goes with unions. So it was a Shochtim's union. So when a lot of people came in the middle of the Second World War, after the Second World War, so they saw that some of the Shochtim were not so observant. Some of them were not such Shomri Shabbos, so they were concerned. Maybe the Shechita is not so good. They're not so medaktik. So they wanted to have more Shochtim who were more medaktik. So they wouldn't let them into the union. And they wouldn't let them shecht. So they had to make a different union. So they said, well, that union is Stam Kosher. We're going to have a Glat Kosher union. So it was really a fraud. It wasn't glat kosher. It was the same as everybody else, except they had shochtim who were more medaktik. But that's what they called at that time glat kosher. Glat kosher meant that our shochtim are more religious than your shochtim. And for Sfardim, that's not enough. Sfardim have to have what's called It's yosef glat kosher, really, really glat kosher. Glat kosher in the sense that the lungs are smooth, and they didn't work hard to remove the adhesions. Any sircha that gets removed very easily, Rabbi Yosef Kai would allow that too. But if you have to rub and rub to get it off, then the Sephardim would be medaktik not to eat such a behemoth.
So today the same definition of glat applies?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Doesn't mean it's smooth.
Right.
What about today, if you go into restaurants, real from, they say we only eat glat kosher. So, I mean, the way you're saying it, it doesn't have to be glat?
It doesn't mean it's glat. It doesn't mean Sephardi is allowed to eat there. Doesn't necessarily
but
mean
that. About Ashkenazim? I mean,
right.
If, in other words, do Ashkenazim have to eat glat? Or you could eat, it doesn't have to be. I mean, they make a whole big thing with glat these days.
You have it in the office too. You don't have that. You don't have the circus there in the office. There, you see, not kosher by the office. What is
by birds? Yeah, by birds. No such thing as glat kosher. Cheese.
Right.
Cheese. No such thing as glat kosher by cheese. In Europe, the Ashkenazim were all mekel and they didn't require glat kosher.
No, here you go to the restaurants here in New York, you know, everything glat.
So okay.
If it's not glat, is it kosher or isn't it?
It's hard to
say. Glat.
It's hard to say. What do they mean by non-glat kosher? It means that we're not so medaktik. Ashotam are not so medaktik. So the term is used with different meanings. So if it means that we were makel to peel off the sircha, so Ashkenazim were makel on that. For many centuries we were makel on that. But in America, it got to have a different connotation, that glat kosher means that our shochtem are more observant, and not glat meant that the shochtem are not such Shomer Shabbos. They're not so medaktic in the whole religion. So we would prefer to have the glat kosher, if that's what it means. We would prefer to have the shochtem who are Shomer Shabbos.
It has nothing to do with the lines then. It's got to do with the shochtem, not
right,
the lines.
Right.
What
does Hasidus Shechita
mean?
What? Hasidus Shechita.
What's the mile of that?
It's not a question of a mile or a chisorim. That was one of the main tainus against the Hasidim. When a big debate began in the late 1700s, early 1800s, between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. So the Hasidim used to be medactic to have very sharp knives. So the very sharp knives. So they said, that's a mile. That you don't have any nicks on the knife, it's so sharp. And then the Misnagdim were opposed to that because the Shulchan Aruch says that sometimes if the knife is too sharp, so you sometimes mistakenly have the sensation as if there is a tegima on the knife. So the Hasidim felt that the very sharp knives were mila, and the Misnagdim were opposed. They thought it was a chisar. No, I think that the Misnagdim gave in, that that's not a problem. He found other Chisroinus with the Hasidim, but not that.
So
he finally gave
so
you
that. What does it mean today? Scientists say Hasidish Shkita, what does it mean today?
It means that the Shoichit is a very religious man.
At that time,
you want to have a Shoichit is a very religious man?
I mean, 100 years ago, at that time, the knives were not stainless knives. The stainless knives are much harder to sharpen there, but they keep the sharpness much longer than there too there. On a non-stainless knife, there's very easy becomes a begam on this one too there.
The Divrei Chaim, Rab Chaim's sons, and once passed the Shochet, he considered him an apikoris. Because he didn't believe in Ha'atzolah, he didn't believe in emanation. By the Hasidim, by many, the Baal HaTanya has this, we believe, Einoid Milvad, that nothing exists in the world outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But what do you mean? I exist, the Shtender exists, the Sefer exists. No, everything is an emanation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever that means. We're not sure exactly what that means. So there was a Sheikh who said he doesn't believe in Ha'atzolah. So Rab Chaim Sanz said he's an apikoris and he can't eat from Hishchit. So people are touchy about what's called an apikoris. So if you have a chesidus shoychet and you think that that's the real McCoy, so he's not an apikoris. If a non-Jew shechts the behemoth, it's an avela. So if a Jew who's an apikoris shechts, so it's in the Shulchan Aruch, an apikoris is dina kinochri. So shechita is no good. So you got to make sure that he believes in the same Jewish religion that you believe in. We mentioned before that Hasidim in America would prefer to eat the buffalo meat. Not that it tastes any better, but rather because there's much less of a problem. There's a very low percentage of sirchas, hardly any sirchas on the lungs at all. And you don't have to get involved in checking the lungs. Then, of course, you have the three dinim in Chumash. You have the din, you're not permitted to eat the dam, blood. You're not permitted to eat chelev, certain parts of the fat of a behema. If you have a chayo, so there's no prohibition of chelev, only in a behema. So it's important to know what's a behema, what's a chayo. A deer. A deer is a chayo. So the exact same parallel, the chelev, the parts of chelev that in a cow have to be removed. You're not allowed to eat it. It's an isa kare. So in the counterpart, the exact same parts of the animal. In a chayo, in a deer, would be kosher. And then you have the gidonoshe. You're not permitted to eat a certain part of the gira nasha. So this is taken care of usually in the butcher shop. That they remove in order to remove the blood. The Gemara says you salt the animal, but that only removes the blood in the capillaries. That doesn't remove the blood in the big arteries. So the Gemara says you have to first yank out the big veins and the big arteries, and then you salt the rest of the flesh in order to remove the blood in the capillaries. So this, usually the big arteries are removed in the butcher shop, and the chelev and the ginanash, this is all removed in the butcher shop. Some people, years ago, people used to salt the meat at home. Now the butcher takes care of that as well. Some people still salt the liver at home. So the Gemara says that the liver, we assume that liver is not the same as the rest of the meat. You cannot just rinse it off and then salt it, and then assume that the salting is going to remove all of the blood. You have to broil the liver. And in addition to broiling the liver, we are machma, you have to have a malicha muetas. You have to salt it a little bit. So it's not so easy. A lot of people make a mistake. They'll let's say you'll rinse off the liver, and then you put the salt on right away. So it says in Shulchan Aruch, that's not right. If the liver, or let's say you have meat, and the butcher doesn't salt your meat, you have to salt it yourself. So let's say in the butcher shop when they salt the meat. So they have to rinse off the meat first to remove all of the blood on the surface. Then they're not supposed to put the salt on right away. The salt will get dissolved in the liquid that's on the surface. So you have to wait till it dries off a few minutes. And after it dries off, then you put on the salt. Now in the liver, when you put on the salt, you have to put it on the fire immediately. If you're not going to put it on the fire immediately, so then we're concerned that the salt that you put on the liver is going to cause the blood in the liver to get absorbed in the liver. So you have to put it on the fire immediately. In the they sell chopped liver in the stores, packaged in the freezer that's frozen. So those companies who make the chopped liver, they don't salt the liver. It's in violation of the minig in Shulchan Aruch. It says that you're supposed to salt it.
In Ashkenaz was a minig also not to salt.
Many communities in Europe, they never salted it, melich muetis, right? But in Shulchan Aruch, they recommend you should do melich muetis. There, they don't do it because simply all the work is done by non-Jews. So they can't have a mashgiach on top of them all the time. It's done mass production. So they can't have a mashgiach insisting that they're going to salt it and put it on the fire immediately. They have so many livers that they're salting. So they did away with the whole practice of salting it in Gans. So when you eat this chopped liver that you buy in the store, you should keep in mind that you're, according to some, you're in violation of an old minhag. According to others, in certain parts of Europe, they never did the melicha muetis on the liver. I remember when I was in the rabbinate, I was there for a few years, that was the first shaila that I got, that a woman salted her liver on Erev Shabbos and she forgot to put the melicha muetis, she forgot to salt it. So the din is that as long as you rinsed it off beforehand, so that wouldn't make a treif.
So what does this salting do again to the meat, to a chicken?
The salting removes the blood in the capillaries.
So you should see the blood in the water, in theory? Where does the blood go to?
No, you have to, after you salt the meat, you have to put it on a klisha menukov. You have to put it on top of something that doesn't have a container on the bottom. Same thing, the liver. You have to have some place where the blood is going to drip down. It will drain down, right? Some people don't know this. Some people broil the liver in a pan, and it's sitting in the pan. So then the blood comes out and it makes the liver treif. So what do they accomplish? So you have to make sure when you salt your meat or when you broil your liver with a melicha muetis on top, so you have to make sure that it's on a container that has a place for all of the blood to drip down.
Like a rack.
Yeah. Correct.
So if the meat is salted and soaked for 6 hours, and then afterwards it looks as if there may be blood there. You're not sure if it's the meat, it's the juice of the meat, or if it's blood. Is it still kosher meat at this particular point, and you shouldn't be concerned?
Yeah, we declare that whatever blood is left after we salted it properly, there is blood left, a lot of blood. We declare that that's mohel habasa, that's the juice of the meat. There's always blood left. So we declare that that's the juice of the meat.
Yes, yeah. It's transformed. That's what you're saying.
Not transformed. No, it's not
what
transformed. The halacha says only that blood that can come out. Let's have a big piece of meat that's so big, and I only put salt on the outside. The inside will absolutely not be affected at all by the blood, by the salting. So the halacha says, however big the piece of meat is, if you salted it the way you're supposed to, and then you rinse it off before you salt, and you rinse it off afterwards, so whatever blood is left is halachically permissible. That's considered the juice of the meat. You can have a lot of blood left in the middle. Yeah.
When you have the meat or the liver on a rack, what about the part of the meat that's on the rack itself that it doesn't drain off, because the rack still has parts that come into contact with the meat? So what happens to that blood?
If you have enough holes, if you have enough open spaces, so we assume the blood will run down. We're not concerned about that.
I mean, is there a shear, like
how wide it can be?
How wide?
No, as long as you have holes at intervals, reasonable intervals.
When you're salting liver, does it have to be only one layer at a time, or more than one layer?
No, in Shulchan Aruch they talk about salting meat or liver with several layers at a time. Yeah.
What do you mean several? You mean several layers of salt?
No, no. I have a layer of meat, then I put salt on top, then I put another layer of meat and salt on top, and a third layer of meat and salt on top, and I assume all the blood is going to drip down.
It's going to go from the top all the way to the bottom?
Yeah, yeah. We assume the blood will roll down. If a person doesn't do it, it's better. Okay, but...
You can have a few pieces of meat, one on top of another, and salt and salt?
Yeah.
I don't know, my mother used to do salt water.
It's better. So it's better. Right, it's better if you don't. But Tysus quotes this, that's permissible to have several layers of meat, one on top of the other.
And you don't have to move the meat, then move it around?
No,
nope.
We assume that everything will drip down. We assume everything will drip down.
What do you think of this new extra stock of the hazard as a result of the agriculture? Is it the same thing as that?
No. That hechsher is just that they're not causing tzar bali chayim. That's taka a proper thing. We should boycott. Rav Moshe Feinstein in his sefer thinks that we should boycott eating veal, because in order to make the veal soft, that it goes down your throat like butter, it's a very soft the veal, so they have to give the calves a special diet. And because of that special diet, the legs of the calves are very weak. They don't have a strength, so they don't have they wobble. They can't walk on their own. Rav Moshe Feinstein saw at that time when he saw the farm. Now it's different, but at the time that he saw it, he thought that it was a terrible tzar bali chaim to the calves. So he thought we should boycott eating veal for that reason. We should boycott eating any food that was prepared in violation of any government laws or any. Any dinim of tzar bali chayim and achinami. There is a prohibition of eating chadash. It says in Chumash that any one of the grains, wheat, barley, oats, rice, spelt, that was planted after Pesach may not be eaten until it comes next Pesach. The common practice, most of the world always was that those who lived far away from Eretz Yisrael were never worried about this. In Eretz Yisrael, they were always concerned about chadash, to make sure that everything is yoshan. Yoshan means that whatever was planted before Pesach, you're not allowed to eat it till it comes the first day, the end of the first day, Chol Hamoed Pesach. So in Eretz Yisrael, they have to be careful. And in Chutz Laaretz, people were always mekel on this. Most the big tzaddikim were always machmer throughout all the generations. Most of the Hamoinam were mekel on this. Even though it says in the Mishnah that Chodosh applies in Chutz Laaretz, it's only a dispute whether it's a din min haTorah, a din min derabbanan. How come everybody's in either a violation of a biblical prohibition or a rabbinical prohibition? What's going on here? So the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch explain that we, apparently the minhag has accepted that Chodosh is only derabbanan in Chutz Laaretz. The biblical prohibition only applies in Eretz Yisrael. And since it's only derabbanan in Chutz Laaretz, it only applies by rotzes hasmuches l'Eretz Yisrael. It only applies in those countries that border on Eretz Yisrael. So if you live in France or Germany, you live in Poland, or you live in New York or Los Angeles, So the whole deal of Chodesh doesn't apply. So that's the minig that most people follow. You have in different places they have a Yoshin bakery, so they're medaktik. So that's the proper thing to do is that we should be medaktik. If we're so medaktik about other things, this is something we should be more medaktik about. This, according to most poskim, that is the din, that the prohibition of Chodesh does apply outside of Eretz Yisrael min HaTorah. So there's no room to differentiate between the countries that border Eretz Yisrael and the further countries. But the minig lamaisa, the minig was for many centuries to be mekel on this. If a person, let's say, has a tree or a bush, and he knows when it was planted, and he knows that the berries or the fruits that are growing grew in the first 3 years since it was planted. So that's orla. So the Mishnah says that you're not permitted to eat orla, the fruits that grow, very often nothing will grow at all the first 2 or 3 years. But if something does grow the first 3 years, so the din, the Mishnah says that that's forbidden both in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz Lords. The Mishnah, however, says that there's a big difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Lords. In Eretz Yisrael, if you're not sure whether it's orla or not, so misofik, you're not permitted to eat it. But in Chutz Lords, any sofik orla is mutter. If you have a sofik, whether the thing is orla, let's say a non-Jew has a whole a farm, and every tree has a plaque and it says when it was planted. Every bush has a plaque and it says when it was planted. So I can go, I ask the non-Jew, I want some grapes, I want some peaches, I want some pears, I want some apples, whatever. So I can easily watch when he's going to pull it off of the tree, and I'll see whether the tree was planted within the last 3 years or not. So the Mishnah says I can close my eyes, I don't have to watch him. Whatever he brings me is okay, even though it's a sofik she'ef shalavar, I can easily be mevarer it. This doesn't even qualify to consider it. If it would have been a din derabbanan, it's not called a sofik derabbanan. You just close your eyes. If it's easy, just walk over and you can ascertain it without even spending any money to find out whether it's treif or not. So that's not even called a sofik with respect to being mekel on a sofik derabbanan lekula. But with respect to orla, the Mishnah says that even though it's only a slight sofik, it's still permissible. Regarding the pears that grow the fourth year, that's called revai. So in Eretz Yisrael, if you have a tree or a bush that grows fruits or berries, so in the fourth year, you're not permitted to eat the peris until you poida them. And you're supposed to bring the peris to Yerushalayim and eat it. Today, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so you're not permitted to eat Maaser Sheni, that the revai in Yerushalayim, unless you have a Mizbeach and a Beis HaMikdash. So we can't eat the revai in Yerushalayim. So since we're not being mafsid the Netter Revai or the Maaser Sheni, so the din is, that's what Tosfos and all the Rishonim say, that's the accepted opinion. You can be paid all of the Netter Revai. You don't have to be paid Bishavyo, let's say in Eretz Yisrael, they have tens of thousands of dollars worth of Maaser Sheni or Netter Revai all the time. So what are they going to do? They're going to be paid, and then we're going to do with the money. You're supposed to take the money to Yerushalayim and buy food. But you can't eat the food if you buy the Rishon because there's no Beis HaMikdash. So Tosfos says, based on the Gemara, that since today you're not really being mafsid the Maaser Sheni or the Netter Revai institution, so just be paid on a nickel, and shine, you can be paid on a pruta, and then you have to destroy that pruta. So that's the same in Chutz Lortz. If you have Revai the fourth year, so that's what that's the way it says in the Shulchan Aruch and the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. There's a question whether the din of Orla does apply in Chutz Lortz, the fruits that grew the first 3 years. That says Beferish in the Mishnah that prohibition applies even outside of Eretz Yisrael. But as far as Revai is concerned, as far as the peris that grow the fourth year, that's a big debate whether that din applies outside of Eretz Yisrael. So in the Shulchan Aruch we're machmer on that. So then there are different opinions exactly how far is the practice that we're machmer, are we only machmer on grapes, or are we even machmer on oranges and apples and other fruits? So the kids of Shulchan Aruch says we're machmer on everything. So any bush that you have, or any tree, if you know that it's the fourth year, so you have to pluck off all the fruits first. You can't be poided while it's still mechuba l'karka. And then after you pluck them off from the tree, then you should be poided them onto a coin, and then you have to see to it that you destroy that coin, to make sure that it doesn't recirculate, make sure that it doesn't get mixed in again with the rest of your money.
That's if a Jew owns the tree.
We're machmir even if it doesn't belong to a Jew. That the din of Orla applies even Mishal Nochri.
So apparently we don't do this anymore, right?
No, in Chutz Lortz, whenever there's a Sofik, it's Mutter. In Eretz Yisrael, even if there's a Sofik Orla, it's also. But the Mishnah says Sofik Orla Chutz Lortz is Mutter. So we rely on that. We never know. There is orla floating around somewhere. We don't know where it is. So it's a safek orla b'chutz lo.
It's a safek because we don't have hashkach on it. If we put hashkach on it, we wouldn't have this.
So the Mishnah says you don't need Ashgacha. You're not mechuyif to worry about it. Then there's a prohibition, there's a pasuk that says, Hayotze min ha'aser is aser. The pasuk lists off all the non-kosher birds, and it says, the bas hayano, the ostrich may not be eaten. So that's the yano. Why is it called the bas hayano? What, only the female of the ostrich are aser, and the male is mutter? So the Gemara says, no, the bas hayano refers to the egg that the female ostrich lays. That a yotzim and hasa is also awesome. An egg is an egg. An egg is not fleshy. An egg is parvim. But still, an egg that comes from a non-kosher bird may not be eaten. And the same thing, milk that comes from a non-kosher animal, one is not permitted to drink it. It's not the same as eating the non-kosher animal. If you eat the chazer itself, then you get malchus. If you drink milk that came from a horse, or you drink milk that came from a pig, so you don't get malchus. That's a lesser isa. It's an isa. It's a pasuk in the Torah. It's a biblical prohibition. It's an isa deraisa. But the Rambam says you don't get malchus for that. It's a lower level of an isa. So that's the prohibition of yotzim and ha'asa. The same thing, let's say you have oranges that grew in the first 3 years on a tree. So if you eat the orange itself, so you get malchus on that. That's the orla itself. If you squeeze out the juice and you drink the juice, you don't get malchus. That's a prohibition of yotzim and ha'asa. But that's considered a biblical prohibition. So it's because of this issue of not, there is such a thing as non-kosher milk. Milk that comes from a horse. In certain parts of India, they drink horse milk. Certain parts of the world, they drink all kinds of, they drink pig's milk and so on. So because of this concern that there are people who sometimes drink milk from non-kosher animals, that's why the rabbis pointed out in the Mishnah that you have to be careful, that you have to make sure that the milk that you're buying is Chol Yisrael. The milk should be, the milking should be done by a Jew, or supervised by a Jew, to make sure that you're not falling in, that you're not drinking non-kosher milk.
Treif
a cow also. Let's say it's a cow, but the cow has a treifus. The cow has a treifus. So it'll also be an Isser of Yotzim and Ha'asa.
I'm actually concerned about most cows today are treifus. Most cows today,
the dairy cows, right? The dairy cows have a very high incidence of treifus. It's taka a big question. How come we're still allowed to drink milk if there's such a high incidence of treifus by the dairy cows?
How do you recognize treifus if they're still alive?
You can put them through an X-ray machine to see.
Well, we don't do that.
We don't do that.
We know if they're treifus or they're dead. By that
correct.
Time they're
a little bit drunk. So what they do, apparently, they milk the cows in America, the system they have now, and they milk the cow 3 times a day, which is abnormal. And that's why years ago they never did that. And because they milk them for all they're worth, so that's why they develop the sicknesses. And then when they were not producing enough milk, then they kill them. So these dairy cows don't taste so good. The flesh doesn't taste so good. So usually in the industry, when they kill these animals, they use this flesh to make hot dogs or salami, because in hot dogs and salami you put in so much, so many spices, you don't taste the flavor of the flesh anyway. Because this flesh has a funny taste. It doesn't taste bad, but it has an irregular taste. So they told me that years ago they used to shech these dairy cows in America, they used to find 80% incidence of treifus. They told me in South Africa that when they shech the cows, they had 98%, 95% incidence of sirchus on the lung. So how can you drink any milk? I don't know.
What's the answer?
I don't know what the answer is. So there was a big tumult about this in Eretz Yisrael about 5 years ago. So they wrote in a different Torah journal. So those who wrote why it's a problem, their essays were very understandable. And those who explained why it's mutter, very ethereal. very philosophical. They had to rely on Rav Shimon Shkop for something, and I didn't understand it. I don't really understand.
And Chol of Yisrael doesn't take care of his problem.
Does not take care of the problem.
Are there people today that are purposely abstaining from milk because of this problem?
There are, yeah. And Eretz Yisrael, they made a big tumult about this, yeah.
So
there are people that don't do it.
Cheese, the butter,
yeah.
Cottage cheese, the sour cream.
So they can't even dare in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Would that be a solution?
You have to find out what the story is by the goats. I don't know. Chol Yisrael just assures you that it's not milk from a non-kosher animal. But now the question is, this cow, which is a kosher animal, may be a treifa. If the animal is a treifa, so then you're also not permitted to drink the milk. Just like milk from a horse is also, so milk from a cow that has a trephis is also also.
So isn't it more important to see if that the cow is not a trepha as opposed to having the mashkia just watch the guy milk it?
It is a problem. They're working on it.
I mean,
they're trying to figure out how to ascertain at what stage, how many months does it take till the animal develops the sirchus on the lungs.
What's OU milk as opposed to halal Yisrael milk?
OU just means it's not Chol of Yisrael. OU relies on Rav Moshe Feinstein's Psak, the Chazon Ish, and many others said like that, that if you have government supervision in a country like America, you have government supervision in some other countries, doesn't mean anything. The government supervision in America, more or less, is a reasonable country over here, so that's considered like Yisrael Re'eh. So that's what Rav Moshe Feinstein said. So what do you need Hashgacha for? Hashgacha is that on milk, they often add on different... they enrich the milk by adding on different vitamins. So some of those vitamins that they add on are sometimes non-kosher. So the OU supervision means that they didn't add anything to make it treif. But they didn't check to make sure that the animals don't have any treifas on them. It could be that all the animals are treif. It's the same as all other. Same as all the other.
What kind of milk? Let's say milk? Milk of coffee.
There's a certain percentage of the animals that have a trephis to them. You see, I mentioned earlier that the Ramban says when you shecht an animal, you only have to check for the sirchus on the lung. You don't have to check for any other trephis because the others are mir che'eino motzei, and the sirchus on the lungs are mir tamotzei. So what percentage is that it's considered mir tamotzei? So traditionally, it has always been assumed that 10% and above is considered neotamotze. So Rav Soloveitchik mentioned that when he used to do hashgacha work on a slaughterhouse in the Boston area, so he used to use all the kulas on the book plus more. He would make a lot on sirchus, on trefus. And his slaughterhouse used to have 14% sirchus. He said at that time, there used to be glatt kosher slaughterhouses, so had only 9%. He said, how is that possible? I'm using all the kulas and not glatt kosher, and it's 14%. He said it's not glatt kosher, it's glatt treif. He said you can't eat by them, they're fakers, it can't be. So that's usually assumed, that traditionally it's assumed that the sirchus on an animal are going to be 10%. So in Europe, when they would milk a cow, so you would take a bucket of milk, you take it home, and you drink the milk. So the odds were 90 to 1, or let's say 14% of sirchus. So the odds were not 90 to 1, 85 to 15 that this bucket of milk is not a trefa. But now they have dairy farms, and they mix all the, they have thousands of cows. They have 15,000, 20,000 cows on the farm, and they mix all the milk together. So if they mix all the milk together, and you know that 15% or 10%, 2%, if 2% of the cows have trefa, so 2% of all the milk they're mixing together is milk from a trefa cow. 2% you don't have shishim already. So it's a problem. So if you have the milk and you mix it into coffee, so now you have shishim. Now you have shishim, because it's going to be bottled in the coffee. But it is a problem. You're not allowed to do it. Ain't allowed to miss lechatchila. If you know there's something... I don't know. I raised the issue in the OU, and they thought that I was crazy. So they ignored it. But not exactly, they didn't ignore it. They commissioned some professor from Cornell to work on it, to try to ascertain how long it takes till they develop the sicknesses.
If someone wanted to, they could open up a kosher dairy farm and...
You can make a racket out of it. Yeah, you can make a lot of money. Sure. It's a very good idea. Yeah.
Like in the airport, you know, when you go through security, you should have the x-rays with all the cows.
Yeah, it would be extremely expensive, you know, to x-ray all the cows.
Are you currently not taking milk? Your current practice, are you not taking milk?
I'm bothered with the kasher, so that's why I'm waiting till I have a good answer. But most of the rabbanim assume that the milk is kosher. I just don't understand why. Then we have, of course, a din of basa b'cholov. Basa b'cholov is a pasuk in Chumash. If you cook meat and milk together, you're not permitted to eat it. You're not permitted to gain any benefit out of it. It's also b'achil and also b'hanor. If it's only basa b'chol of the rabbanon, let's say chicken and milk, we assume is only prohibited mid rabbanon. Or to eat, let's say I mixed together meat and milk, but I didn't cook them together. I just mixed them together. So that's only forbidden mid rabbanon. So basa b'chol of the rabbanon is muta b'hanor. Let's say if by mistake, balabas made a mistake and she cooked meat in a milchik pot. So does that make it basa b'chol of manatar, basa b'chol of mid rabbanon? So that's a big dispute. So most of the big poskim assume that that's basa b'chol of the raisa, and sometimes by mistake you made something treif, so you give it to your non-Jewish neighbor, you give it to the non-Jewish worker in the house. But if it's basa b'chol of the raisa, then it's also b'hanor, so you're not allowed to give it away as a gift to a non-Jewish friend of yours. So it's important to know what's basa b'chol of the raisa and what's basa b'chol of the rabbanim. We have a chumrah. Not only is there a din, you're not permitted to eat meat and milk together, if even though they weren't cooked together, that's also awesome. The Rabbanon, the Gemara has a minhag that you have to wait between one meal and the other. If you had fleshiks, you have to wait till you have milchiks. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes the common practices that one, the Rambam writes, one wakes kimo sheishos, approximately 6 hours. That's the common practice. The people either wait 6 hours, the people wait a little over 5 hours, a little over 5.5 hours, between one meal and the other. The Gemara says, one of the Rabbanim says, I'm not a tzaddik like my father. My father, when he would have fleishiks, he would wait 24 hours to have milchiks. And I'm not on that level of observance. I only wait from one meal to the other. So from one meal to the other, as Rambam writes, is approximately 6 hours. In the Shulchan Aruch, some of the commentaries say that waiting 1 hour is really a din mid rabbanon. Waiting more than 1 hour, waiting the remaining 5 hours or the remaining 4.5 hours, whatever, that's only a minhag. What's the difference whether it's a din de rabbanon or a minhag? So the question is, what if you have a shas hadchak? When will we permit a person to have milchiks within 6 hours? So it says in Shulchan Aruch that they quote the commentaries on the bottom of the page say that in order to permit a person to have milchiks within 6 hours, you don't require that it should be a chayla. You don't even require that it should be a chayla she'en bo sakana. If he's a bari with a mechesh bi'alma, if he doesn't feel well and he really needs the milk, years ago they used to assume that people who had ulcers, if they would drink warm milk, it would solve the problem. Now they came to the realization it's absolutely lamala v'lamora that the milk doesn't help. But years ago that was what they thought. So if a person has some kind of a condition and he needs milk to help him out, so we would be mekel on the 6 hours. But to be mekel on the 1 hour, the first hour, that the Kaf HaChaim said that's a real din de rabbanon, so we would only be mekel on that if the situation would be such that the person would be a chayla she'em or sakana, that he's talking not feeling well. A little more than a bari with a mechesh bi'alma.
Why isn't hunger just mechesh bi'alma?
I mean, if a person has nothing else to eat, he has nothing part of it.
No, why isn't that? Being hungry is certainly is.
So if he can eat fleishiks, if he can eat more fleishiks, let him eat some more fleishiks, let him eat part of it.
For the whatever it is, that certainly is strong as a mechesh ba'alma, which is not.
No, mechesh ba'alma means that he has some aches and pains. Physically, he has some aches and pains.
He ate a hard lunch. The type of eating is stronger than the
nature's volume. I don't know. I don't know about that. Then we have the Gemara says, people think that this is an issue of kashrus, but it's not. This is an issue of good health. The Gemara and Pesachim, in the days of the Gemara, they relied on the doctors of their time. So there weren't too many Jewish doctors. The Chasam Sofer says they relied on the non-Jewish doctors, on their expertise. So the non-Jewish doctors in the days of the Talmud told them that if you have meat that was cooked together with fish, that's considered a sakana and a person may develop tzaras, whatever tzaras is. So that's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. You have to be careful not to have meat that's cooked together with fish. So then the post can have a discussion, what if it's chicken that was cooked with the fish? Does it only apply to meat flesh or does it even apply to chicken? So they're not sure. So they say you should be machmer on that as well. The Magen Avraham in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch writes, the Magen Avraham was written in the 1600s, so he says that today we haven't heard that anybody is developing tzaras from eating the fish with the meat, so he thinks that there's no problem. The later poskim are not so convinced. What do you mean? But if the Gemara says that this is a sakana, how are we so convinced? The Gemara, in the days of the Gemara, also wasn't such a common sakana. It was also a far-fetched sakana, but the Gemara says you should be concerned about it. So usually we avoid having fish and meat that are mixed together, unless you have shishim. Unless you have, that's a question. What if you have a little bit of fish juice, let's say, fell into a pot full of meat, and you have shishim in the meat against the fish. So if a little bit of milk would fall into a pot of meat, you would have shishim in the meat, and the Mishnah says that it's bottled the shishim. That you're talking about treifas, but if you're talking about the sakana, so maybe the sakana applies even if you have shishim in the meat against the fish. So that's a big debate in the Apostle. So the Nadi Behuda writes like this. He says, look, Magen Avraham thinks that today there's no sakana bechlal, so we don't have to worry about it at all. And even though we still are concerned a little bit, but we're not mechuyev to be so concerned to the extent that even if you have shishim against the fish, it's also not batal. So that's why a lot of people are in the practice of using this Worcestershire sauce when they cook meat. The Worcestershire sauce has fish in it, so anchovies in it. So if it has chunks of anchovies, so that's not, you can't say it's batal. But if the whole thing is liquid, so very often you'll have shishim against it. So if it says oh you fish, it means that it does not have shishim. If it just says oh you, it means that it has shishim against it, even though the thing you read the ingredients is going to say that it has anchovies in it. So then the Nadi Behuda says that that's not a problem. Okay, others are concerned about that. They do consider that as a problem. All of these things that you're not allowed to eat, the non-kosher meat, and the chalev, and the dam, the non-kosher fish, and the nevela, everything you're not allowed to eat, so if you eat it, you get punished. You get a punishment of malchus, or what, sometimes you have a kores. If a person eats chalev, a dam, there's kores. So the Gemara said that's only if you eat a kazayas, if you eat the volume of an olive. If you eat the tiny little bit, there is no punishment. So the Gemara has a hold, but you're not allowed to. You're not permitted to eat even a little mashu. So the Gemara has a famous dispute. What is the nature of this prohibition of a chotzi shir? If you eat less than a mashu, less than a kazayas, is that a biblical prohibition or a rabbinical prohibition? The accepted opinion is that this constitutes a biblical prohibition. It's also an atarah to have a tiny little bit. So then the Gemara has another discussion. You have three psukim in the Chumash that speak about a situation where you're not really eating the non-kosher thing itself. Take, for example, someone cooked non-kosher food in a pot, and then I wash out the pot, and then I'm going to cook some kosher soup in that pot. So I have no non-kosher ingredients, but we assume that the bliya from the non-kosher food gets absorbed in the walls of the pot and is going to go into, there's going to be niflat into the kosher soup that I'm going to cook now. So the Torah tells us in two different places that you have to kasher the pot. You have in Parshas Matos, when the Jews waged the war against the Midian, and when they were successful in the war, so the Pasuk says that they took all the pots and pans, they took all the non-kosher pots and pans from the goyim, and then they wanted to use them to cook kosher food, so Eliezer, Elozer HaKoyin told them that they have to kasher the pots and the pans. Some of them have to have hagola to put them into burning hot water, bubbling hot water, 212 degrees. And some of them need more than hagola, need the libun. You have to burn them over a fire in order to get out the treifa bleed. So you see from that pasuk that not only are you not permitted to eat the chaza, you're not allowed to have kosher food that has a flavor of chaza that was absorbed into it. That's called tam kiker. The tam of the non-kosher food went into the kosher soup. That's considered as if you're eating the non-kosher thing itself. The tam of the non-kosher food is like eating the iker, like eating the real McCoy. You have this.
24 hours.
We'll get to that in a minute. 2 minutes. Then you have the same din mochomer repeated in Parshas Tzav. It says in the Torah that if you bring a korban chatos, only kohanim can eat it for the day and the night. Let's say someone brings a korban chatos Sunday morning, 9 o'clock in the morning in the Beis Hamikdash. So the kohanim can eat the flesh of the korban chatos Sunday and Sunday night, minatora all night long, with the rabbanon have to finish eating it by chatzos. So then the Torah says, but the kohanim cook the korban chatos in a pot. So if tomorrow, Monday morning, someone's going to bring a korban chatos at 9 o'clock in the morning, they're going to cook that chatos in the same pot. So the bliya from yesterday's chatos is going to come into today's food that we're cooking. Yesterday's chatos became nifsal bolino. That's considered noisa today. So if you have leftover flesh from yesterday's chatos, you're not allowed to eat it. Here, I don't have any leftover flesh. The kohanim made up the chatos yesterday on Sunday, and then they washed out the pot, spick and span. They washed it with a detergent, so there's no leftover. But there's leftover bliya in the pots. The bliya from yesterday's chatos is in the pots. So the Torah says you have to kasher the pots. On Monday morning, you have to kasher the pots before you, either it's a question Monday morning or Sunday night. It says in the Torah you have to kasher the pots before you want to cook Monday's chatos in the pot. So again, you see, even though you're not actually eating the chatos that itself was left overnight, you're not eating the noisa, you're eating today's chatos. The kanim on Monday are eating today's chatos, which has a flavor, a little bit of a flavor of yesterday's chatos left over in it. So the Torah says, still, the tam is kikah. And then we have the third pasuk in Parshas Noso. Torah says that a nazir is not permitted to drink wine. So not only is he not allowed to drink a cup of wine, if he dips his challah into a cup of wine, and he squeezes out the wine, so the challah is just going to have a little flavoring of wine in it, it just has a tam of wine. So the Chumash calls this, v'chol mishras hanovim, lo yechal. If he eats something that was soaked in wine, mishras hanovim, he's not permitted to eat. So Gemara says, here you have three psukim in the Chumash, by Giulei Klei Midyan, that you have in Parshas Matos, you have the kasha, the trefa pots, that they confiscated from the Midyonim, that the goyim had cooked in, the goyim cooked chazer in the pots. So you have to kasha them, and then in Parshas Tzav, it says the Kohanim have to kasha the pots before they cook today's carbon chatas, so they shouldn't have a bliya from yesterday's chatas. Then you have the third pasuk by the Nazir, he's not permitted to eat the bread that absorbed the flavor of the wine, even though he squeezes out the wine, so there are no droplets of wine left in the bread, it just has the flavor of the wine. So the three psukim put together teach us this din of tam kikah, that you're not permitted to eat kosher food that has the flavoring of a non-kosher food. So basically, let's say I go to the store and I buy non-kosher food. I'm not buying chazer, I'm not buying the veila from the AMP. I'll buy some baked goods. So how treif could it be already? It's not going to have a kazayis of chazer schmaltz in it. It's going to have less than a kazayis, and I'm not eating the chazer schmaltz itself. I'm just eating a product that has a little bit of flavoring in it. But since we put the two rules together, we put together the rule of chatzi shir asam and atayra, together with the rule of tam ki ikar, even though what I'm eating is basically kosher, the non-kosher ingredient is way less than 50%, but it's nice and tam, you can discern the flavor. So then the din is that tam ki ikar even applies to a chatzi shir, so that's why you have to have a supervision on everything. Now the Gemara points out that biblically this prohibition in the Chumash that says when they won the war against the Midyanim, apparently it was a very short-lived war. They won the war in less than a day. So the Gemara says that La'osu Torah L'Kedera Bas Yoyma. When the Chumash says, Elazar HaKohen told the soldiers they have to kasha all the trefa pots that they confiscate from the Midyanim, that only applies if they want to use the pot for kosher soup within 24 hours of when the non-Jews used it for their chazer, or for their ham and eggs for breakfast, whatever. But if you wait till tomorrow, you wait 24 hours, so them in Atar, there's no problem. Why is there no problem? So the Gemara explains why we consider this nice and tam livgam. When do we say that if you eat a kosher food that has a little bit of flavoring from a non-kosher ingredient, that it's an iser? That's only if the non-kosher ingredient either enhanced the flavor of the food or didn't enhance and didn't detract the flavor. But let's say the non-kosher ingredient detracted a little bit from the flavor. You can discern that it has a non-kosher ingredient in it, but it tastes delicious. The food tastes delicious. It would have tasted better if it would have not had this non-kosher ingredient in it. So that's called, in the halacha, that's called nice and tam livgam. The non-kosher ingredient is pogim a little bit. The food tastes absolutely delicious. Everyone will enjoy it, but it would have tasted better if it wouldn't have had this non-kosher ingredient. So that's called nice and tam legam. So that's what the Talmud says, most of the time, 98% of the time, if you have a pot that I cooked chazer in it over 24 hours ago, and the chazer, the bli of the chazer in the walls of the pot was sitting there with the charsis hagdeira, and it absorbed the metallic flavor of the pot, or absorbed whatever the material the pot is made from, so it's sitting there for 24 hours, so that will cause the flavor of the treif of food to be legam. So whatever I'm going to cook it in, whatever soup I'm going to cook now, it's not only not going to enhance the flavor of the soup, it'll detract slightly from the flavor of the soup. The new kosher soup I'm going to eat will be delicious, but it would have been even more delicious if the pot wouldn't have had that non-kosher flavor. So biblically, there really isn't any need to kosher any pots. Just wait 24 hours and your problems are solved. So the Gemara says that the rabbis were afraid if we'll leave that din on the level of the Raisa, so people are going to put stickers on all the pots. So they're going to put, this pot was used for fleishiks at this time. This pot was used for chametz at this pot. This pot was used by my Goyishan neighbor at this time. So we'll have stickers on all the pots. And we'll have to wait 24 hours to be able to use it for whatever else we want to use it. So what are you going to do if the stickers are going to get all mixed up? So you're going to be cooking some kosher food in a non-kosher pot within 24 hours. And it made Gzera D'Rabbanon that you always have to kasher. Even after 24 hours, you have to kasher the treif pot, and you shouldn't use it for kosher. So that's a big dispute in the poskim. How far did this gzeir the rabbanon go? So one of the rishon and one of the prominent rishon of Rabbeinu Aaron Halevi, that's the Rebbe of the Ritva, he held that this gzeir the rabbanon only applies on trefah pots. It doesn't apply between fleshiks and milchiks. So he only had one set of dishes, and he just waited 24 hours. So he was the only one. So his students pleaded with him, Rebbe, of course you're right. We know everything, we're convinced that you're right, but everyone says you're not Pekiris. How do you do that? He said, right is right, he doesn't care what they say. He insists that he's not gonna spend money to have two sets of dishes, two sets
what
of pots.
What did he do with the ovens?
Waited 24 hours. No problem. He just waited 24 hours, fleshiks to milchiks, and no problem. So this opinion was never accepted. So on Shulchan Aruch, the only debate you have is the following. This din de rabbanon is a gzeira. We require that you should kasha the pot even after 24 hours, because you may make a mistake and you'll cook some food in the pot within the 24 hours. So we usually have a rule in the Gemara that the rabbis have no right to make a gzeira l'gzeira. They only have a right to make a gzeira de rabbanon if there's a reasonable concern that someone's going to make a mistake and violate a biblical prohibition. What if the rabbis are concerned someone's going to make a mistake and violate a rabbinical prohibition? So that's not sufficient cause to make a gzeira de rabbanon. They're not allowed to. They're not allowed to make such a gzeir l'gzeir. So that's what some are of the opinion, that if the treifa pot only became treifa in the first place because I cooked and nisa derabanan in it, so then after waiting 24 hours, you don't have to kasha the pot. So that's not the generally accepted opinion. The shach is the main figure in Yerudea. I remember when I visited Eastern Europe 2 summers ago, so they were giving us a tour of Vilna. So they kept on talking about the Vilna Gaon, all the time, the Vilna Gaon, where he lived and where he davened and where he walked and so on. So I said, what about the Shach? The Shach lived in Vilna also. So the woman, the tour guide says, no, the Shach was not a rabbi. He taught secular studies to the students. So I told her the Shach is quoted much more often than the Vilna Gaon is in all rabbinical literature. Shach is the most prominent figure in Yerudea. His opinion usually carries a day. So the Shach's opinion is that this prohibition that you have to kasha the pot even after 24 hours go by doesn't only apply if you originally cooked treifas, that's awesome, not there, even if you only cooked something that's treifas, there are bunnies, still have to kasha it after 24 hours. The thing is that the Shach himself admits, what if you cooked something in a pot that's not even osur midirabbanan? It's only osur because of a minhog. Let's say someone cooked kidneys on Pesach. By mistake, whatever they cook kidneys on Pesach. So do you have to kasha the pot? The prohibition against eating kidneys, Ashkenazim, have such a minig, but only kidneys, it's only a minig, it's not even an Isad Rabbon. So the Shach himself writes in the second Chelik Yerudea that if the food is not even treif mid Rabbonon, it's only osam itam minig, so then after you wait 24 hours, then you don't have to kasha the pot. Now in Eretz Yisrael, it's a big issue. You have religious Jews, so they eat the peiros that grew during the Shemitah year. The Americans, people in America don't know what's going on, so people think peiros that grow in Shemitah are treif. They're not treif, it's a mitzvah to eat. Some say you say Ebrocha, Shekinashan, Mimitzvah, Sivitzivano, Alachilas, Peiros, Shviyas. The Ramban counts it as one of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. That Hoysa Shabbos, Hoysa Lehem, Liochli, you should eat the Peiros, Shviyas. It's not treif. It just has restrictions there. You can't do whatever you want. You can't throw it out in the garbage, but it's not that it's treif. So the question is, let's say I cooked some Shemitah peiros, holy peiros, I have a Kedushas peiros, I cooked in a pot. And then the din is that you have to eat all of the fruits and vegetables that grew during the Shnas HaShemitah by a certain date in the 8th year. This is the 8th year, the year following Shemitah. So every fruit and vegetable has a Shas HaBir. So these fine religious Jews in Eretz Yisrael, they were observing all the laws, so they ate the perish base and they cooked it in their pots. So what's the din? They cook the fruit or a vegetable that has a shas habiyo, you're not allowed to eat it after, let's say, Tu B'Shvat. And now they want to cook some soup in the pot after Tu B'Shvat, so they have to kasha the pot. Even though at the time that they cooked the food, there was no problem. That's like the Kohanim cooking the chatos. The Kohanim cooked the chatos on Sunday, and then they finish eating everything, they don't leave anything over. But then, when it comes Monday, they can't cook Monday's chatos in the same pot. That's what it says in Chumash and Parashas Tzav. They have to kasha the pot, because the blia from yesterday's chatos will come in today's chatos, and they'll be eating yesterday's chatos today. So the same over here. If you're going to eat if you're going to eat, if you're going to cook some soup in the pot, after Tu B'Shvat, or after whatever the Shas Habir is on the various fruits and vegetables and grains, then it's going to have a blia from yesterday's Perish Vias. So this is a big shaila. So Rabbi Shlaima Zalman Auerbach said he can't believe that there is such a din. It doesn't say anywhere in the Gemara that you have to kasha. He said over there, you just wait 24 hours and you call it quits. You don't have to be machmer on that. But you talk, have to wait 24 hours. That's a big issue now. The OU, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he told Rabbi Ganak when he took over the supervision in the OU, he said in Eretz Yisrael they have a Shas HaTchak, so they rely on the Het Mechira for Shemitah. He said, we in America, we're not involved in the Shas HaTchak, so don't get involved. He says, so don't give any supervision on anything that that relies on the Het Mechira. So the OU does not. So the question is now, they're producing, they're cooking vegetables, they're cooking fruits and vegetables on the same pots where they cooked the peris that did rely on the Het Mechira. But they're waiting 24 hours in between. So is that enough, or do we have to insist that they have to kasha? You have to ask Rabbi Ganak what he passed.
That's also this one as a Rabbanan, right?
Yeah, it's only the Rabbanan. The Badatz is Mekel. The Badatz is Mekel on it. If you wait 24 hours, so then they're not Machmer.
It's a glass pot.
Now the question is, which pots are we talking about? What kind of pots are we talking about? So the Shulchan Aruch said that Rabbi Yosef Kar writes in the Shulchan Aruch that glass is not boleya. So glass doesn't pose any problems. You can use it for fleshies, for milchiks, for chametz, for Pesach. For all year long, glass is not boleya. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Pesach that the Rabbanim from France and Germany, the Ashkenazim, were not so convinced of this. So that the truth of the matter is that the glass is not boleya. You know it's not boleya. But the Rambam was machma. We treat as a chumrah, as a minig. We treat glass as if it's worse than a normal pot. We treat it as if it's a kli cheres. If it's like an earthenware vessel, that hagola doesn't even help. You can't even do hagola on a glass pot. So we're Ashkenazim on machmer on glass, and the Sfardim on mekel. The Sfardim will have one set of dishes, glass dishes. They use it for fleshiks and bilchiks, for chametz and for all year long. And they don't have to kasher at all. Now we have stainless steel pots. So stainless steel is also balea less than glass. Glass is balea mashahu, stainless steel is balea less than a mashahu, less than the glass. So we have to get all the rabbonim from the whole wide world together. Mashiach will come if we'll ever succeed in doing that. We have to get all the rabbonim together, a convention, and we should all decide, shayim, mikar al haba, that the stainless steel doesn't pose a problem. But we haven't yet had that convention. So we're still machmer on the stainless steel pots and pans. There are some exceptions to the rule that if a pot was not used for 24 hours for the non-kosher food, we still do consider it nois and tam l'shvach. So one exception to the rule is wine. If you have vessels, they have liquors that you buy in the store, a lot of schnapps, is aged in sherry casks. It means that they had a wooden barrel that had wine in it. And then they emptied out all the wine, and then they used that barrel way after 24 hours. They'll use that barrel to age the schnapps in it. So obviously the wine is not less than time of gam. Adarab, it gives a proper flavor into the schnapps. So this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that this is considered an exception to the rule, that if a wooden container, if it's a metal container, we assume that it's going to be less than time of gam. But if it's a wooden container, or a klicheris, an earthenware container that had wine in it, so even after 24 hours, we don't assume that it's going to be nois and tam l'vgam. Or another example, an exception to the rule, that they have a treifa pot that someone cooks mamish a treifas in, and then today I'm going to cook some food a week after, a year after, I'm going to, not a year, take back the year, a month after, so I'm going to cook some kosher food now in the pot, and this kosher food is very spicy. So then the Gemara has a chumrah that the Rishonim interpret in the Gemara, this chumra, that if you're cooking a dove charef in a pot, something that's very, very sharp, even though it's after 24 hours, because the food that you're cooking now has a harifas, so the flavor that comes out will not be poigim, the non-kosher flavor from last month will not be poigim b'miktsas, it'll be nice and tam l'shvach. In Shulchan Aruch, they have another example of a unique status of a davar charif. That's the more popular din that people are more familiar with. The pasuk that we mentioned before, There are three psukim to indicate that if you have kosher food that has the flavor of non-kosher food in it, so tam also asks, even though it's a chatzishir, even though it's only a tam, way less than 50%. It should have been bottled beroy, but still, since it's nice and tam, so it's also. So the one example was the nozer shishora pita biyayin, mishra sanov, in parshas nosov, the nozer puts a piece of challah, soaks it into the wine, and he squeezes out all the wine, and the piece of bread has a little bit of flavoring from the wine. So that's that. The Chumash says the nozer is not allowed to eat it. So that's one example of a kosher food absorbing a flavor from a non-kosher food. The wine for the nozer is considered non-kosher. For everybody else, the wine is kosher. For the nozer, the wine is considered non-kosher. So because he soaked the piece of bread in the wine. So clearly, the bread is going to have a flavor from the wine. Let's say, stam, if I have a piece of kosher food and non-kosher food, and they're both cold, and you rub one against the other, it doesn't make a treif. You have to scrape off whatever's on the surface. There may be some non-kosher, little bit from non-kosher food got stuck on the surface. Once you scrape it off, so there won't be any problem. If you cook the kosher with the non-kosher together, so cooking together, bishul will give an asinas tam. Or if you soak something in a liquid for 24 hours, so that will give an asinas tam. But let's say I have a treif and knife, and I cut some cold food with the treif and knife, so it doesn't make treif, everything is cold. So an exception to the rule, the Gemara seems to give this exception to the rule, is if I have a treif and knife, even though the treif and knife hasn't been used for treifus in the past 24 hours, and I'm cutting something very sharp, as for example, usually people assume an onion, that's usually assumed to be the example. You're cutting an onion, which is very sharp, with this treif and knife. Now, everything is cold, and the treif and knife hasn't been used in 24 hours, but because the onion is a dover charev, so we assume, number one, even though the treif bli is more than 24 hours old, it won't have the cool of nice and tam levgam. And number two, even though everything is cold, usually when things are cold there's no bli at all, but if you have a duchkir sakino, you have a sharp, either I'm sticking a fork into the onion, I'm sticking a fleshy fork into the onion, so you have the prongs of the fork are going in a sharp fashion. If I have a chopped up onion and I take a spoon and I take out some onions, that's not, there's no duchkir sakina. But if I'm sticking a knife, I'm using a knife to cut the onion, I'm poking the prongs of a fork into the onion, so I have the duchkir sakina, the sharp pressure, together with the dover charev, so that does make treif. If the fork will be treif, that'll make treif. Or let's say if the fork will be fleshig, or if the knife will be fleshig and I'll cut an onion with it, so we would assume in Shulchan Aruch that that will make it fleshig or milchig or whatever the case happens to be. They tell a story about Rav Chaim Volozhiner, that once a woman came, the poverty was unbelievable. We can't be masik what it's like. So a very poor woman came on Erev Shabbos and she had a shayla that by mistake she cut the onion with a milchig knife, and then she took this onion, she threw it into the pot of flesh, and the whole story. So what did she do? All the flesh became treif. Rav Chaim Volozhiner saw the woman was very poor, so he asked her, what color shell did the onion have? So the students are listening, where does this say in Shulchan Aruch? So did it have a black shell, did it have a brown shell? So she said, Rabbi, I had a brown shell. She never saw an onion with a black shell. In other countries, apparently, they do have onions with a black shell. So he said, everything is kosher, you can go home and eat the food, it's okay. So the students asked him, where did he get that from? So he said, he doesn't really agree with this whole din in the Shulchan Aruch, with the onions, there's a machlokes, whether it even applies to onions, are only to things that are even sharper than onions. The Gemara talks about a very sharp vegetable that's sharper than onions. So he thought the din was not like the Shulchan Aruch. But he says, not going to paskin against the Shulchan Aruch. But he says, Rabbi Yossi Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael. He lived in Tzfas. He says, in Eretz Yisrael, the onions have black shells. And he thinks that things that have people with black hair are sharper than people with blonde hair. That's what some assume. And onions that have black shells are sharper flavor than the onions that have brown shells. So he says he's not paskining against the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is only talking about the onions in Eretz Yisrael. He says the onions in Chutz Laaretz, if it's a brown shell, so for the poor woman he had to be mekel. So usually we're not mekel on this. Usually we assume that onions that are not cooked, let's say if you start cooking onions, say after, if you're frying onions on the fire, say after 2 minutes of cooking, they already lose their harifas. And there won't be any problem of davar charev afterwards. But let's say I have a treifa pot and I'll fry onions on the pot. And the pot hasn't been used for treifas in the last 24 hours. So since the onions are davar charif, so we will assume even though the pot hasn't been used in 24 hours, it'll make a treif. But let's say I cook the onions in a parva pot, and then after they're cooked for 2 minutes, they lose the whole charifas. Then by mistake, I took, let's say, a treif, a spoon that hasn't been used in 24 hours, and I'm going to scrape out the onions from the pot, and everything is burning hot. So then we'll say, won't make a treif, because after the onions are cooked for 2 minutes, that they lose the whole charifas. So these are two exceptions to the rule. That if you have
a soup that has onions in it, so are we worried about the charifas of the onions, or we say
a soup that has onions cooked in it, the charifas will have already been lost a long time ago. If you can have a liquid, you can have a soup that has dava charif in it, but it has to be very charif. Onions usually after you cook for 2 minutes, so there won't be any charifas anymore. You can have a soup that will be charifas, but not due to onions.
What about a davar sheyesh lo matirin? Would there be an exception there after 24 hours? Or would we say that since if you wait another, let's say, something that will become kosher after a week or something like that, would the 24 hours still apply to a davar sheyesh lo matirin?
Yeah.
Because it's only with Rabbanan that it's not bad? That davar sheyesh lo matirin.
Yeah.
Not bottle, right?
But after 24 hours, is nice and tam livgam. We assume everything will be nice and tam livgam, with few exceptions. Only if it was wine that was absorbed in a wooden container or klicheris, or whatever was absorbed in now, cooking a davar charif. So by davar charif, we have the chumah.
Even though by davar sheyesh lo matirin, you can say if you wait, it'll become kosher to begin with.
Yeah.
And yet we would still rely on nosim tam livgam.
Yeah.
So that would be an exception.
I think so, yeah.
You can't wait 24 hours to begin eating it. Was that what he was asking?
No, I'm saying something that would become kosher, let's say,
should
a week.
Should I put it away in the refrigerator to keep it for a week?
Right.
I don't think so. I don't think you have to.
Would
I think we would assume that it's mutter. Yeah.
The basic who said if something is part of the lung, the lung itself is treif, but the rest of the meat is kosher.
If you have what? If you have treif or lung?
The lung, if something is part of the lung will tell the treif. But the rest of the meat is there.
No, it can't be.
Nobody?
No, can't be. No, they used to ask students who learned here every day, how is it possible that the leg of the animal is nevela and the rest of the animal is kosher? Well, how is it possible that the leg of the animal is kosher and the rest of the animal is treif? So these are trick questions, but on the lung it's impossible. On the leg, it's a possibility, a far-fetched possibility. No, that's not possible.
After meat, can you use the same pot for fish the next day?
If you wait 24, if I cooked, we're careful not to cook meat and fish together at the same time, so the poskim say if you waited 24 hours, you can use a flesh. Usually women have a separate fish pot. So the achrayim say if you wait 24 hours after having cooked the meat, then you can cook the fish in the same pot. Then you have to wait 24 hours after having cooked the fish to cook meat again in the same pot. Yeah.
If you cut an onion with a fleshy knife, and you eat the onion, do you become fleshy?
No, it says you don't have to wait 6 hours. Let's say I cooked some soup in a fleshy pot that was used for fleshies in the last 24 hours. So that I should treat the soup as if it's a fleshy, but I don't have to wait. I don't have to wait 24 hours for that. And Shulchan Aruch, that's what's known as not by not. Nois and tam by nois and tam. Means like this, let's say I cook fleshiks in a pot, and then I removed all the fleshiks, I washed out the pot, there's no bien. And then I cooked parva soup in the pot. So there was a fleshik flavor that was deposited in the pot, and now that fleshik flavor came out from the walls of the pot, it went into the soup, so that's a nesinas tam, bar nesinas tam. So strictly speaking, the Gemara seems to say that soup remains parva, and it doesn't become fleshik at all, and you can pour it into a milchik bowl, and then you can mix in milk. That's the simple reading of the Gemara. So the Ramban, Shulchan Aruch writes, we don't follow that because Rashi's son-in-law, Rashi only had daughters apparently, so one of Rashi's sons-in-law said he heard from his father-in-law, from Rashi, that if you have Nesinas Tam by cooking it, so that's a bigger problem. So if you cook the soup in a pot that was fleshig, because I cooked fleshigs there within the last 24 hours, so that soup will be fleshig. So Tysus thinks that he must have had wax in his ears. Tysus thinks that he must have made a mistake. He didn't hear straight. Rashi probably never said it. But that's what the son-in-law said. So that's the way it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. So we're machmer for that. L'chatchilu we're machmer. By nois and tam, ide bishul. we're machmer for that. But the Sfardim are not machmer. Sfardim are mekel. If you cook, let's say, to cook lechatchila part of a soup in a fleshik pot, intending to mix in, to pour it into a bowl, intending to mix in milka, intending to mix in butter, even according to the Sfardim, that would be improper. But it'd be mikre. You cook part of a soup in a fleshik pot, and then you put it in a bowl. You want to mix in some milk, so the Sfardim would say it's mutter. Ashkenazim say that you're not allowed to. But B'di'evit, if you did, if you made a mistake and you did put in the milk, so then the Ramo would also agree. But B'di'evit, it doesn't make a trade. You don't have to throw it out. This whole chumrah that we're choshish for, Rashi Sanallah quoted in the name of his father-in-law.
It depends if it's hot or cold. It depends that if it's cold and you put milk in there, it's tender. But if it's hot there, the soup is still hot there, and you put milk in there, it's something else.
Why should it make a difference?
Reading it.
No, I'm talking about it. It's a keli there. It was you make a soup there.
Yeah.
Cook it, soup in a fleishig keli.
I cooked a parva soup in a fleishig keli.
In a fly, you cook it in there and still hot the soup there. Then you put milk in there. That's a kashan.
So the chatchili, you're not allowed to put milk even after it's cold. You're not allowed to. You're allowed to have this soup, when the soup cools off, you're allowed to put it into a milchik pot. Even though you cook the soup in a fleshik pot, the meaning is that we don't pour it while it's burning hot into a milchik bowl. But let's say it cooled off already, it's no longer burning hot, so then you're permitted
to put milk in there.
So l'chatchila you're not allowed to put milk even after it cools off. Even after it cools off, we wouldn't allow that. But b'di'evit, if you did put in milk even when it's burning hot, we would say it doesn't make a trick. But the other Ashkenazim would also be mekel, it doesn't make a trick.
So if you cook a soup in a fleshik pot that hasn't been used in 24 hours, and it's a part of a soup, so then can you eat that soup with milchitz?
Yeah. It's not proper lachatchila to cook soup, to cook part of a soup in a fleshik pot that hasn't been used in 24 hours. You're not allowed to do that lachatchila intending to mix in milk later on.
Not to mix in milk. No, you're going to eat it at the meal with milchitz.
Yeah, so lachatchila we wouldn't allow you to cook this part of a soup in a fleshik pot that has been used in 24 hours. We wouldn't allow you to do that lachatchila if you plan to serve it in a milchik meal. We're going to have drinking milk at the same time. But if you did it already, you already cooked, you weren't thinking. You cook the part of a soup in a fleshik pot that hasn't been used for fleshik in the last 24 hours, and you didn't know what you're going to do with the soup. Then later on, you permitted lechatchila to serve it with milchitz, because the fleshik pot hasn't been used in the last 24 hours. But this for sure, let's say a person had part of a soup that was cooked in a fleshik pot that is fleshik, that has been used for fleshik in the last 24 hours, that says you don't have to wait 6 hours after that. The minute of waiting 6 hours only applies if you had actually fleshik, or you had, let's say, potato kugel that had a lot of schmaltz in it. But if the potato kugel was just cooked in a fleshik pot, even if there was, let's say, you didn't really wash it out so well. When you cooked the fleshik originally, you rinsed it out and there may be a little bit of flesh left over, but it's not that it's a lot of schmaltz in the kugel. So then you don't even have to wait 6 hours after that.
You don't have to wait how long?
Nothing.
Okay.
You have to wait. You just make sure you don't have any fleshik in your mouth at the time that you have the milchik. We do assume like that, yeah. In Shulchan Aruch it says, let's say we washed the dishes in a dishwasher on the sink and we threw in detergent before we had the burning hot water applied to the dishes. So whatever, let's say these were fleshig dishes from last week. Do they become fleshig again when I pour on the burning hot water today and it still has fleshig particles? So if I have fleshig particles plus that I have detergent, so then when the bli of the fleshig goes in, it goes in with the detergent, so we assume that that's called nosen tam levgam. So the Shulchan Aruch says that doesn't make it fleshig again. So it's only considered fleshig from last week. Unless I always had detergent. You always had detergent, so it'll always be nosen tam levgam.
If the pot was used less than 24 hours ago for fleishigs, and one did cook without intention of adding milk, but he did cook in it, are you saying that it's...
Rabbi Yosef Kara says that it's permissible lechatchila to have it with milk. And the Ramo says that it's not permissible lechatchila to mix in milk, But b'di'evit, if he mixed in the milk, it wouldn't make a treif. B'di'evit, we would rely on Rabbi Yosef Kar. Our chumra is because Rashi, son-in-law, the Rivon, said that he heard from Rashi that nois and tama, they bishul, if it's cooked in the pot, the kula of nois and tama doesn't apply.
Okay, so we apply not for not only to, let's say, putting it on a plate, not cooking, mixing it on a plate.
Right, if I had, let's say, had a fleishig bowl, and I put burning hot parva soup in a fleishig bowl. So the fleishig bowl is cold. I didn't cook the soup in the fleishig bowl. So then that would be called nois and tama. So I can pour the soup into a milchik bowl and put in butter. The Ramo would say that's permissible. But if I cook the parva soup in a fleishig pot, so then we're machmer lachatchila, but then if I pour it into a milchik bowl, I'm not allowed to put in any butter.
On another matter, are there still people who are machmer not eating fish with milk together? Or is that long shot?
The Belzer Hasidim in Eretz Yisrael broke off and they made their own Hashkocha and they made their own Bezen for the Gitna, Chalitzis and everything, so they had to explain why did they break off from the Eirach Haredes, from the Badats. So you know and I know, we all know why they broke off, because the Badat doesn't take any money from the Memshala, and the Belz took millions of dollars to build the Beis HaMikdash over there. It took a fortune of money, so that's why they broke off. But they're not going to advertise that that's the reason why. So they started their own newspaper. So in the first or the second volume of the newspaper, they had explained their position. So they said, because they're upgrading the standards of kashrus, that Rachmana Litzlan, the Eirach Haredes allows in their restaurants, they allow them to fry fish with butter. Yeah, they hear such a thing, fish with butter. Unheard of. So they are makbid, they don't allow fish with butter. The Shach and Yeridei writes that those who wrote like that, they're just like fish and meat is a sakana. So fish and butter is also a sakana, and the Shach says that it's a misprint. He thinks that it's not correct. But there are those who are still machmar yamazah.
For health reasons.
For health reasons. Supposedly the same sakana that the Magen Avraham says, he doesn't know what they're talking about today. He thinks it doesn't exist. But in the days of the Gemara, the doctors were convinced that there's a suffix sakana if you have meat cooked together with fish. So some understood or misunderstood that the same sakana applies if you have fish that was cooked with milk, a fish that was cooked with butter.
So the OU doesn't hold by that?
Most follow the Eirach Haredes. Yes. Most follow the Eirach Haredes on this. Yeah, they led us to believe that it's okay. Most are not machma like the
Belz. So cheese and lox is still okay?
It's assumed that it's okay. Yeah. That's what they said. That's what all the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch said. What do you mean? Fish fried in butter is a sakana. They say everybody eats it, and I haven't seen that anybody get sick. That's what the Magen Avraham argues about the fish and the meat. He says people eat fish and meat cooked together. Also, we haven't seen that anybody gets sick. So that's why the Magen Avraham thinks that this sakana of the fish and the meat doesn't apply today. And the later poskim say we're not so convinced. But the fish and the milk, that most assume that doesn't apply. Okay, we'll have to continue some other time. Good. Good to watch. Yeah.
You mentioned the phrase boiled at 212 degrees. Is it boiling or 212? Like Denver, what boils?
209. Boiling is good enough.